From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with actor Elliot Gould. He's best known for his starring roles in the movies MASH and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. In his new film, Inside Out, Gould plays an agoraphobic, a man afraid to leave his own home. Also today, I talk with country singer K.D. Lang. She challenges the conventions of traditional country music with performances that draw from the blues, rock, performance art, and camp. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back on the career of Smiley Lewis, a New Orleans blues musician who died in undeserved obscurity. And book critic John Leonard reviews Bluebeard, the new novel from Kurt Vonnegut. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is actor Elliot Gould. He became a star in the late 60s and early 70s with such films as Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, MASH, The Long Goodbye, Little Murders, and California Split. He was a leading man with eccentric good looks, an erotic energy, and a quirky sense of humor. But after the mid-70s, his career took a downward turn. In 1984, he starred in a short-lived TV series, ER, about an emergency room physician. TV Guide featured an article about the show that said that Gould had been exiled to B-movies because of reports that his bizarre behavior made him difficult to work with. Gould's latest movie, Inside Out, about an agoraphobic, opened and quickly closed in New York over the summer, but it's scheduled to open on the West Coast this week. Elliot Gould was in Philadelphia today for a conference at Temple University on college campus activism. One of the organizers, Bobby Seale, met Gould when he played the role of attorney Leonard Wineglass in a cable TV movie based on the Chicago 7 trial. I spoke with Elliot Gould earlier today. Before he made movies, he starred in several Broadway musicals. He got his start in show business as a child, singing and dancing on local TV shows and in the Borscht Belt. I asked him if it was his idea to go into show business at such an early age.
Oh, no. I didn't think that I was capable, nor was I terribly willing to perform or expose myself in any form of performance.
your parents were behind this?
My parents were advised attending a school for singing and dancing would perhaps help me come out of myself and deal with my being rather withdrawn and very shy. And
since you started off in show business a little unwillingly, when you came of age, did you try to get out and did you consider a career as a lawyer or a doctor or a businessman instead of show business?
Well, as I like to reflect, the meaning of career emanates from a Spanish word, which means an obstacle course, like in a racetrack, and mine is extending itself. I was brought to Charlie Lowe's Song and Dance School, where they also taught personality, and I was asked whether I would consider to learn to tap dance, and I thought as an 8 or 9 year old boy that it didn't seem to be unmasculine, and although I would have preferred to have said I'd rather be a fireman or a cowboy, I wasn't aware of being a child. I was rather serious-minded, and I thought my ambition would be to blow a bugle and have the walls come tumbling down, but I knew that that was written someplace and it happened before. So I acquiesced to learning how to tap. The first time I appeared in a troupe with some of my fellow students as a rather precocious group of singing and dancing kids, there were two adult performances happening as well. One was Buck and Bubbles, who were great vaudevillians. In later years, I worked with John Bubbles. I staged something for him. He was the original Sport and Life in Porgy and Bess. And the other performer was Josh White, Sr., a great folk singer. And I believe in history, and I thought that was great. I could memorize things, but my heart wasn't in it. I had no real belief in myself at that time.
You started as an adult in musical comedy before you made it into movies, and I've never seen you sing. I've only seen you in your movies. Have you heard me sing? No, I never heard you sing.
Oh. Didn't you see any of my Saturday Night Lives?
I did, actually. But
You saw me sing, but you weren't listening.
Well, what did you sing on them? I'm trying to remember.
I sang, the second time I did the show, I did Times Have Changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they would try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse, and so on and so forth. And when I finished it, I said, and tonight, everything goes. I like that. No one wrote that for me. The first time I did Let Yourself Go, Irving Berlin, as you listen to the band, don't you get a something or other. Bubble, I guess. And then I did Crazy Rhythm, which I used to perform in the Catskill Mountains. Crazy Rhythm, here's the doorway, you go your way, I'll go my way. I worked at the Palace Theater on the same bill as Cliff Edwards, who was the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
And Ike.
Ukulele Ike, Fascinating Rhythm, that was his theme song. And I followed Smith and Dale, who were the original Sunshine Boys, you know.
Well, you've actually resolved something for me, because I was always trying to imagine you breaking out into song on the musical stage. And in so many of your movies, you have these great kind of off-the-cuff, half-mumbled lines that are so funny, little throwaway lines. And to think of you exuberantly breaking out into song on Broadway was always a stretch for me, but now I feel like I've experienced it.
Well, I started out in the chorus. I mean, I love it now, you know, I really do.
You love what, stage? The stage? Musicals?
I love to sing, mm-hmm. and I also appreciate movement. Groucho Marx was a very good friend of mine in his latter days. He used to let me shave him with his electric razor while he'd stand and watch reruns of Jack Benny and Burns and Allen. And he said I didn't have to think about dancing, that I move so well, and for me to continue to move. And then he said that I didn't have to act like him any longer. He thought I was good enough to be like Harpo.
Oh, well.
You look a little like Harpo.
I look like Harpo?
A little bit, yeah.
I talk a little bit more, I guess. My guest is actor Elliot Gould. When you were also early on in your career, you studied with Lee Strasberg at the Actor Studio. And I think at about that time you went into psychoanalysis. Was that something that you had to do to study with Strasberg?
No. Actually, at that time, I was living with my first wife. And, of course, we were married. Yes, we were. And I went to Mr. Strasberg's private classes, not at the Actor's Studio. They were at Carnegie Hall. And I took 3 sessions with him. At the same time, I saw a psychoanalyst. And I took more than 3 sessions with him, and it was a good experience. I have a very good reference as to what the psychoanalytic community does.
Does it help in acting to have been psychoanalyzed?
It certainly helps to understand yourself.
The role that really put you on the map in the movies was Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. That wasn't the role. That was the movie.
The role was Ted.
The role was Ted, yeah. Right. And I wonder what you thought of those characters. These were 2 sets of couples who had decided to experiment with spouse swapping and group sex. What did you think about the role that you were playing? What did you think of that person?
Well, the first time that the material was presented to me, I was extremely skeptical, and I didn't think that I could trust it in relation to my ethical and moral ideals, and so I shied away from it. And then it came back to me, and I went in and I met Larry Tucker and Paul Mazursky, who wrote it, and of course it was Paul Mazursky's first directorial assignment. And there's a wonderful bedroom scene between my character and Diane Cannon, who played my wife. An extremely funny, very real encounter between a sexually starved husband and his wife. And the rhythms of the scene were so good, and it seemed to be very positive, because when I read with them, I felt that I could do it. Diane wasn't cast at that time, and we had to do some screen tests. And I discovered my first objective relationship in that picture, whereas the four characters each had a fantasy. My wife's fantasy was that every man in her mind would want to be with her. And it was dramatized as a dance, and every male in the picture had a ticket to give to her so she could dance with every male. And I was there as well. We were working on a soundstage at Columbia Pictures. At the same time, Spencer Tracy was next door at another soundstage doing Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Miss Hepburn. And we had to break for union regulations. We had about 400 or 500 men and this one woman. And so I decided that I really had no place to go, and everybody went off the stage, and I stayed there, and it was just the camera and me. And it was the first time, because when I'm working, my mind is open, that I realized that what I was afraid of was that the camera would show me as I really felt about myself, which I was not terribly
comfortable with.
That's right. I wasn't too comfortable with myself. But I realized then that the camera was inanimate, and it was me that was frightening myself, not a camera. So I made my peace with the camera, and it became my very good friend. And ever since then, that's worked for me.
You know, one thing I think actors are so lucky to have is lines, lines that are written for them and people that they could be. It must be so exciting to have a personality that you can fit yourself into and become, where you don't have to think of, well, what am I going to say? The lines are written for you. And if it's a good role, the lines are written for you very well.
Well, I consider the lines to be one thing, and the words that compose the lines are composed of to be something more. I don't ever have a problem with my lines. Every now and then, I'll have a problem with some words. But then in my work, the next picture I did was MASH with Robert Altman, and he gave me the opportunity to exercise an improvisational flair that gave me enormous range.
What were the rules of the game on MASH when there was leeway to improvise? Where were you expected to improvise? How did that work?
That's very interesting, because when Ring Lardner Jr., who wrote the screenplay, finally saw the picture, most of us were outside waiting for him to come out to see how he felt about it. And he came out and was totally offended and furious. He said, "I haven't seen one of my words. And how could you have done that? And I'm devastated." And the result was that he won the Academy Award for the best screenplay. And at one point in the picture, where Robert Altman was composing this picture, I don't know that Donald and I knew what it was that he was doing, but he certainly knew what he was doing. And I was very energetic, and being that I wasn't being specifically directed, and being that I came from the precision of being a tap dancer and coming from the theater, I would intuitively fill my role with the energy and the heart that I felt was appropriate. And at one point, Bob Altman got very flustered because he was fighting time. We were going to break for lunch, and it was a scene that seemed to be rather non sequitur. And we were all sort of lying around across a brook. And I was talking about some relationship with a long-haired Oriental girl. And Bob had this shot coming across with a camera that was on a crane. And I distracted him. Alfred Hitchcock explained that to me later on about anyone making themselves too, making themselves exceptional. But I wasn't trying to make myself exceptional. So at lunch, Bob Altman attacked me, and he said, "Why can't you be like Corey Fisher, who was a very tall fellow who was also in Brewster McCloud from the Committee in San Francisco, which is sort of a satirical group, and I'm not a part of a satirical group." And I started to shake. I had my lunch on a tray. I hadn't eaten it yet, and I threw my lunch up without having eaten it, and I said, "Look, I am not going to stick my neck out for you again. You'll tell me exactly what you want, and that's exactly what I'll do. But don't treat me like this." And he said, "I think I've made a mistake." I said, "Evidently you have made a mistake." He originally offered me the role of Duke, the part that Tom Skerritt played, the American Southerner. And I had just been fired from the theater. I was trying to do a play called A Way of Life, which is pretty funny, by Murray Shiskow. And I was fired. But because of my objective relationship with the camera, I didn't destroy myself. And I felt somewhat offended that I felt I was sculpturing a character, a role, to do 8 times a week in theater. And that the insecurity and the doubt of the establishment in relation to the materialism of the field, in the field, they sort of shattered my work. And I was somewhat offended because I had auditioned for it. And Shiskal had said to me, "Why can't you be as good in rehearsals as you were when you auditioned?"
So what happened with Altman? Did you go back to improvising after that incident?
That was the day that Dick Rush came to visit me on the set to talk about doing Getting Straight. And Altman then gave me another scene that was not in the script, and it was a scene where we were playing poker. And the officer and his assistant from the other camp, who we played football with, came, and his assistant wore sunglasses that had mirrors on the outside. And Altman said, "You're going to be playing poker with all the boys, and you're going to see that guy over your shoulder, and what I want you to say to him is there's 2 ways to get killed in this war. One is to go to the front lines and fight, and the other is just to stand over my shoulder with those glasses while I'm playing poker." And again, I played poker. I'm not the best poker player in the world, but I am an expert. And I was shining. It was so much fun for me. And I have found that when I'm radiating, the audience feels the same way as me. And Altman said, "You ruined the scene." I said, "Oh, no. Oh, no." He said, "Yes, you're too outstanding. You take my mind away from my picture." I said, "Before you kill it, look at it. I think that it's going to come across as something." Because again, when he had offered me the part of Duke, I said, "All I'll be doing will be justifying to my ear that I'm an American Southerner. And I'm very insecure that I'll offend legitimate people from that territory."
So the scene stayed in?
He said, "You were right," and this scene stayed in. So then I said to Altman, "But if you can give me the part of Trapper John, I've got real spirit and energy for you, and I think I can bring something to your picture."
Well, you must have finally got along well, because he cast you in The Long Goodbye and California Split.
California Split was a picture that I had lived before, and that's when we came into total harmony.
Well, I want to talk with you about that, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is actor Elliot Gould, and we'll talk more about his life and his work after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Elliot Gould is my guest. We just alluded to the fact that when Altman cast you in California Split, a movie about two gamblers, that it was a part you felt you had kind of lived.
No, I had lived it. The fellow who wrote it and co-produced it with Bob was a child actor like myself by the name of Joseph Walsh. And in real life, we gambled at a time. And I was, in real life, the character that George Segal played, and he was the character that I played.
What kind of things did you gamble on in real life?
Football, baseball, basketball, very few horses. I think there may have been one or two, boxing, and cards.
Was that, did you lose a lot of money or make a lot of money?
My philosophy now, which I'm enjoying, is that as much as I love to win, I hate losing more, and that there's nothing I need that I can win. I have to make it for myself. And with that in mind, and now being in balance and in harmony, occasionally I'll pay to play because I enjoy the excitement, but I don't want to put myself in jeopardy or be at the mercy of anyone else.
Were you gambling at the time you made the movie?
Oh, yes. We built the casino in the upstairs at Mapes in Reno, and we would simulate the gambling scenes upstairs and then come down and gamble in the real place.
Right. In the last few years, I haven't seen you in as many movies as I would have liked to have seen you in. Is this choice on your part, or is there something else that's happened?
Well, I'm doing a lot of pictures now. I just wrote in this last several days to Ingmar Bergman on his island.
And you did a movie with him in 70 or 71 called The Touch.
1970, yeah, called The Touch. And Ingmar had said to me then that people thought he was crazy and that he wasn't, but that he worried about his health because he didn't know anyone who could continue his conscious work. And then he said, but now that we're working together, I know you can direct, so I'm not so afraid. Now, this past February, 1987, Liev Ullmann told me that he never said that to anyone before or since. I wanted to confirm that with his agent, Paul Kohner, who was John Huston's only agent for John's entire career. And Paul said, this is true. There hasn't been anyone since you, and there wasn't anyone before you, and why didn't you use that as a cue to bring us a script? To which I replied, because my personal ambition is a distant second to my family, and my family has been so divided that until I could know that I've done everything possible and reached everyone, then I can start to concentrate to do my work. So I wrote to Ingmar within the last few days here in 1987 to tell him that I'm preparing to direct, but that I still must act to live. But I don't mind it too much because I appear to be improving, and that my children are wonderful and growing in every way, and that my wife is fine, and that Barbara wanted to know how he felt about Yentl.
This is Barbara Streisand, your first wife.
Yeah, mother of my first child, yeah.
You were in a movie a few months ago called Inside Out.
Ah, yeah, which... it's opening tomorrow in Los Angeles.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, it had opened in New York, I think, a few months ago.
I had one screen on Earth, which was my ideal. You know, one screen. I mean, I really believe that the human race must all come into the same computer.
So what's going to happen with this movie? You play an agoraphobic in it, someone who's basically afraid to leave the house.
I play someone who hasn't left his house in 4.5 years. I play someone who is... reflects the condition of the human race. Someone who is paranoid, extremely frightened, totally alienated, who thought or thinks that he could insulate himself against reality by not leaving his apartment, and everything that he's afraid of happens. So it was a great opportunity for an actor to get into this condition, and for me to transmit information through the role. It's not a popular picture, nor is it a commercial picture, but I think it's a significant piece of work.
Are you still interested in comedy?
Oh, sure, I love comedy. I just had a meeting this morning with some British producer who wants me to do something called Run for Your Wife, which is a classic English drawing room comedy.
Do you think there's a connection between depression and comedy? Do you think that sometimes people who are given to depression off screen are terrific stand-up comedians or comic actors?
I think anyone who strives to reach heights must also appreciate and accept depths. And last year, when my second television series didn't work, Together We Stand, which was an ideal of mine, Together We Stand, I thought it's okay to be a little depressed because I must work. And in relation to economy, in relation to reality, in relation to the unfortunate materialistic state of our environment, I was somewhat depressed because I have not been terribly realistic about my life in the world. But I thought, gee, with all these peaks and valleys, it's okay to feel depressed. It's all right to be a little sad, but I don't want to dwell in it. But I didn't know any limits. You see, Ingmar also said to me back then, prior to validating me as the next director, that he said, you've gone beyond your limits and you'll have to live more to understand what you've done. And at the moment, being that we were in production, we were at this 2,000-year-old church in 1970, B.B. Anderson, Ingmar Bergman, and me, I didn't have the confidence to say, stop everything. I don't think I'm doing anything different than anyone else. And if you see something I don't presume that I know what I'm doing. I don't know any limits, and I don't want to hurt myself. I need direction. I need you to work with me. I didn't have the confidence, so I couldn't stop. But that was also part of my design, because I feel that people are so blind to the reality of nature and what it is we have to share, that I wanted to come as far out as possible to get a picture of what's going on here and then try to make my way back, which I am.
So now you feel you have more confidence.
I have confidence. I had no confidence before. Now I have.
Are you getting offered the kind of roles that you want?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of being offered roles. I've done everything that I intended to do, and now I want to develop my own product and make my own pictures. In terms of my ambition, I'm very ambitious, and my great ambition is to be a great-great-grandfather. So is that I can know the children of the children's children's children. Now, I am a father, which is my favorite role, and I hope someday to be a grandfather, and so and on and on. I like being me very much, and I look forward to living the next moment as well as now.
One last question. Do you like to watch your older movies? Do you ever go back and watch them?
My older movies come out here, so I don't have to go back to. They're being projected, so I don't have to go back to see them. My older movies have legs and propel themselves into the future. I've told my children and my friends that some of my pictures are better and some of my pictures aren't, but that there's something in every one of my pictures. I'm living and I'm alive in every one.
Elliot Gould, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here. My guest has been actor Elliot Gould. He's best known for his roles in the films MASH, The Long Goodbye, and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. His new movie, Inside Out, opens this week in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ted Solotaroff. He's a senior editor at Harper & Row and has written extensively about literature and the current state of the publishing industry, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, country singer K.D. Lang talks about stretching the boundaries of country music. Her performances include touches of blues, rock, comedy, and theater. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers Smiley Lewis, a little-known New Orleans guitarist and singer who had a big influence on many early rock and rollers. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new Kurt Vonnegut novel, Bluebeard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the late blues guitarist and singer Smiley Lewis. In his heyday, many thought he was as good a performer as Fats Domino, but Lewis never got as far.
One of the phrases I've always associated with New Orleans is too much. There's too much to eat there, too much to see. People almost always wind up drinking too much, and during the years when it flourished as a rock and roll capital, there was always too much talent for all of it to be recognized. Some important New Orleans musicians, like the man who taught most of the city's great piano players, Isidore Tutz Washington, were never even recorded in their prime. Others, like Smiley Lewis, were recorded but just had bad luck. If you ever wanted to get Smiley Lewis mad at you, all you had to do was call him by the name he was born with, Overton Amos Lemons. He hated that name, and early in his career, a fellow musician had noticed the big grin slapped across his face and said, "Hey, look at Smiling Lewis," and the name stuck. Lewis was one of the most popular musicians in the New Orleans clubs, playing guitar and singing blues numbers, sometimes in a trio that featured Tutz Washington, and sometimes alone, strolling from table to table and making up lyrics on the spot. When the record companies descended on New Orleans in the early 50s looking for talent, Smiley Lewis was a natural.
You ain't nothing but a playgirl. Stay out all night long. You ain't nothing but a playgirl. Stay out all night long. She loved to drink her whiskey and sing her old bluesy song.
The trouble was, his early records all sounded like someone else. Playgirl, which we just heard, was an obvious knockoff of Hound Dog by Willie Mae Thornton, and not even Fats Domino's piano playing could save it. But Smiley soon hooked up with Fats's arranger, Dave Bartholomew. Smiley was about the closest New Orleans artist playing early blues, Bartholomew later told writer John Broven, but he graduated. He always seemed to have the best material. And so he did. In 1955, he released I Hear You Knockin', but just as it started to take off, Gail Storm, a white vocalist, recorded it and took it to the top of the charts. She didn't have Huey Piano Smith playing piano on her record, but nobody cared about that. Still, like Bartholomew said, Smiley had good material, and his next song had a great catchy melody.
One night of sin. My name. It makes me feel so ashamed.
trouble was, One Night was about catching a venereal disease, not exactly top 40 fare in 1955. 3 years later, Elvis Presley, who loved the song, rewrote it to say, One Night of Love is what I'm now praying for, and got a number one record out of it. But Smiley kept at it, and Imperial, his record label, tried hard to put him over as they had Fats Domino. When Elia Kazan filmed Baby Doll in New Orleans, Smiley contributed a great rocker, Shame, 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 to the soundtrack. This time, it was the movie, not the song, that got banned. By 1960, Imperial Records had decided they weren't getting anywhere with Smiley Lewis, and he signed with OK Records, where he recorded Tore Up. Smiley was getting tore up. He developed stomach cancer and passed away in 1966, alone and unknown, except to fans of New Orleans music. A few years later, Dave Edmunds had a hit with I Hear You Knockin', and people rediscovered Smiley Lewis, another casualty of a city with too much talent.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Monday night on the Country Music Association Awards show, a group of young singers joined Hank Williams Jr. in a song about their brand of country music, a style influenced by rock and roll and urban blues, but one they hoped Hank Williams would still be proud of. One of those singers was K.D. Lang. With the reception her first American album is getting, it looks like she's on her way to becoming a star. K.D. Lang grew up in a small farming town in Alberta, Canada, listening to Broadway show tunes and rock and roll. She was doing performance art in college when she discovered Patsy Cline.
I think the way that she incorporated blues, bebop, and soul into country music really enticed me, because that's basically the same areas I was interested in.
Before you started singing, you were doing performance art. Can you describe some of the performances that you used to do?
Well, I guess I could. I don't really like to, because performance art is actually for the moment. To talk about them really is a little bit dull, but we did a 12-hour reenactment of the Barney Clark plastic heart surgery, which was very interesting. One person played Barney Clark and laid on the table for 12 hours without moving, which was in itself a great feat. And I played the surgeon, and constructed a heart out of pickled beets and pickled carrots. And we took it quite seriously, and at the end of it, we were all quite dazed by the whole situation.
What was the reaction of your art friends to your new interest in country music?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. They thought that it was another form of performance art, and that I would do it in the paradoxical sense. But I was trying to explain to them that no, country music was very near and dear to my heart, and that I wanted to do it in a straight manner, straight to me, being the way I do it now. They didn't quite understand it, but I think that they understand that my intentions were clear for quite a few years, and that I'm doing what I always wanted to do.
Going down to Nashville when you were starting out and trying to be a straight country singer?
No, I don't think that ever crossed my mind at all. I've been pretty strong-willed from the beginning to do it basically my own way.
Your own way includes a lot of humor and also a lot of theatrics. Were you ever afraid that serious country music fans would interpret what you were doing as a mockery of country music?
Sure, I was faced with that in many instances, but I think it was just a matter of time, and for them, I think they just had to realize that I was another incarnation of the type of humor that we saw in Minnie Pearl or Grandpa Jones, and we play on the humor of small town or country elements.
On stage, you wear a lot of costumes when you perform, clothes that are versions of country and western type outfits, but are maybe just a little bit more so, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think I do.
Could you describe some of your favorite outfits for performing?
Probably my favorite skirt is one which my mother made from my sister's bedroom curtains. Very comfortable, and I think the skirt has great vision from sitting in the window for so long.
I think maybe it takes a performance artist to think about things like that.
But it's true. I have a pair of boots which has become a trademark of mine, which are a pair of old cowboy boots given to me by a Polish-Ukrainian farmer in Concert, Alberta, which I have sawed off the tops of them, so they're just ankle cowboy boots. I sawed them off primarily for practical reasons. I didn't like tucking my pants in, and my pants were too tight to go over top the boots, so I just cut them off. And I like to take a more androgynous approach to the physical country look.
You know, I have a feeling that when you perform that a lot of the people in the audience end up having a crush on you, both men and women. And I always wonder what it's like to be the subject of so many people's fantasies. Are you aware of that? Do you feel that?
Yes, because I feel that for other artists and other people. I think that's partly what an artist sets out to do. Not necessarily on a sexual level, but to feel compassion for someone who is giving you part of their soul, which an artist does. And if it reciprocates, that probably is the whole intent of art itself.
Are there any country songs that you really like but that you wouldn't sing because you think the lyrics are too sexist?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I come across them by the hundreds.
I think that's a real problem in music, or sometimes songs are really wonderful, but if you listen closely to the lyrics, they're
disgusting.
Yeah, they're sexist or racist.
They're disgusting.
Your choice is to not sing it or to rewrite the lyrics or to try to transcend the literal meaning of the lyric. What would your approach be if you really liked a song but you couldn't really put your heart into the lyric?
Steal it. Steal it and write another one.
Steal the melody and write another lyric?
Not necessarily steal it, but write one with the same intent. But I do that quite a bit, actually. I try to take the feel of a country song and make it more aesthetic lyrically.
What's an example of a song like that on your new record?
Let me see. Died of Strange Places. A very straightforward traditional country song, playing on the intent of starving, perhaps in a typical country song would be sexually, and then I turn it into starving spiritually.
Gone through different phases in your career, and I wonder if you think you'll be changing again. I mean, do you feel wedded to singing country music for the rest of your singing career?
I think country music will always play a major role because it's ingrained in my soul. I don't think that you can ever stop those influences from coming out. I hope I never stop changing, let's put it that way.
KD, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
KD Lang and her group The Reclines can be heard on their first American record, Angel with a Lariat. She spoke to us from station WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, Costa Rican President Oscar Arias, of course, has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. We'll have a story on that and also reaction from Washington. Medicare is reported to be coming out with a proposal to use price incentives and lists of selected doctors to help control Medicare costs. Doctors are mad. They're charging that the government is meddling in how they practice medicine. Also, a story on companies that are finding it a lot cheaper to promote health among their employees with worksite wellness programs. And some music tonight. Most steel drummers come from Trinidad, but not Andy Norell. He's Jewish and he's from Queens.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of a new novel from Kurt Vonnegut. It's called Bluebeard. And like the villain in the Bluebeard fairy tale, the main character in this book has many secrets locked away.
By now we ought to realize that Kurt Vonnegut is not so much a novelist as he is a fabulist, with the cunning of Aesop, the gloom of Grimm, and something irrepressibly American as well. He dreams his way into the heads of symbolic citizens, soldiers, writers, scientists, philanthropists, and politicians. And the weather inside these heads is raining confusion. History comes down hard and hurts. In book after book, he proposes a return to civilizing texts, the Sermon on the Mount and Lincoln's Second Inaugural, Robert's Rules of Order, and the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He might also include almost anything by Kurt Vonnegut, a one-man civilization, as baffled as his typical characters. The symbolic citizen in his new novel, Bluebeard, is the 71-year-old, one-eyed, abstract expressionist painter Rabo Karabekian. Rabo is a child of survivors of the Turkish massacre of the Armenians, which gives Vonnegut yet another genocide to grieve. He's a veteran, like all Vonnegut antiheroes, of World War II, which he spent commanding a platoon of artists so good at camouflage that half the things we hid from the enemy have never been seen again. And he's a post-war Greenwich Village intimate of Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, once divorced, once widowed, twice a failed father. Rabo, who can draw anything, was never as good as Pollock or Rothko at the sort of abstract expressionism that paints absolutely nothing but itself, although he's aware that this art knows something he doesn't about birth and death and liquid time. His own work has been destroyed, quote, thanks to unforeseen chemical reactions between the sizing of my canvases and the acrylic wall paint and colored tapes I applied to them. Because he took art instead of money from painters who once needed a loan, he can afford a misanthropic exile in the Hamptons with an empty swimming pool and a locked potato barn. There he's invaded by one Cersei Behrman, the sexy author of shockingly frank and enormously popular novels for young readers. She disdains the art of nothing and bullies Rabo into writing the memoirs we are reading. And then the Bluebeard of the Hamptons takes this feminist Cersei into the potato barn, the Forbidden Chamber, to meet his last will and testament, his secret art. There are the usual dark chords, but Bluebeard is also full of grace notes, lovely moments that seem to fall in Vonnegut's pages like autumn leaves, such as the brain surgeon who sees himself as a radio repairman, fixing us to hear signals from someplace else, and the magic, the pure essence of human wonder, in the new painting and the old music. As always, Kurt Vonnegut tries to balance his fabulous books. Bluebeard is neither his best nor his worst, but typically good, and therefore probably better than we deserve.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Kurt Vonnegut's new book, Bluebeard. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with jazz trumpeter and bandleader Buck Clayton. He was one of the great sidemen in the Count Basie band in the 1930s and 40s. Then he went on to record and tour the world with his own bands and with others. Now in his 70s, Clayton has written an autobiography. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a CBS Masterworks compact disc featuring the late conductor George Zell. And Jan Harald Brundvand will debunk another urban legend, this one about the choking Doberman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.